Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Dave Schrader, your host for the next 4 hours. Tonight, we've got a great show lined up for you. We're going to be talking about two of the most enigmatic characters in history, Harry Houdini for the first 2 hours and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in the last 2 hours. It's an evening spent with Houdini and Doyle. And starting that up, we might as well launch right into the fact that if you've been missing it, shame on you. Fox Network has been airing on Monday nights for the last 9 weeks an awesome series called Houdini and Doyle. It's a fictionalized account of their friendship and done in an X-Files or Victorian X-Files style show where each week the main characters, along with the first female investigator for Scotland Yard, look into cases of the strange and unusual, the paranormal. And one of the actors, as a matter of fact, the lead actor for the show, Houdini and Doyle, is joining us right now, Michael Weston. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Good to talk to you again, Dave.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you, Michael. You guys are coming in. You've got the season finale is on Monday, the 4th of July. You've got this 10-part series that came out. Fantastic series. What's it like to take a character that is so beloved and so revered around the world for his abilities, his mind, his physical attributes, and then to try to bring him to life in more of a fictionalized setting? Was that tough to do?
First off, it was so much fun. There are all the pressures of it because you actually see how much people love this guy and what a piece of our history he has been and continues to be. And so there are a lot of pressures with it, and you want to do your best. You want to sort of fulfill everyone's, you know, wildest dreams about this guy. But there was something really spontaneous that happened during the course of the shooting, and after the first two or three episodes, we started to really find each other and get our chemistry going, and it became very present time as we were shooting it too, which I feel was really spontaneous for the comedy and allowed this guy to sort of come to life in the course of the series, and with a lot of the historic points of his life that we were true to. There were we also sort of fudged history a little bit to bring all of these characters together and make the most exciting series.
Well, and in reality, Houdini and Doyle were very steadfast friends, and even though they held differing opinions on things like the supernatural, spiritualism, and the occult, but this was kind of a neat idea when they came to you with the idea, hey, Michael, we want to do this kind of Victorian X-Files with you're kind of the Scully. We've got Stephen Mangan playing Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, kind of the Mulder of this series, and bringing you guys together. Were you excited about the idea of doing this new version of paranormal?
Totally, man. I love the skeptic versus the believer, and I love where it asks a question of us that I don't think has really ever been answered, and even those of us who are consider ourselves a realist or a pragmatist or just not involved in any of this stuff. I feel like there's never a solid answer for, what really happens, after death. There are a lot of question marks in the supernatural and all that stuff. And I love that this series, even the hardened skeptic like Houdini, and he was in his, in his real history. He has the ultimate combatant in Doyle, who is the total believer, and also such an intellect. And the two of them get to really duke it out. And I love that you never really quite get the solid answer. I feel like in every episode there's a question mark, or there's one little piece of closure that Houdini would like that isn't quite there. And I think that's very real. I sort of feel that for myself in life. I want to say I know everything about everything, but when you get right down to it, I don't really have proof of anything. So,
you guys have done a great service, I think, to the entertainment field by bringing something like this out, giving it a different twist. You've got kind of that steampunk feel to the series. And then it's pretty neat that you guys are actually incorporating other famous people. You've got a Bram Stoker episode and the Strigoi episode, which was phenomenal. You've got Thomas Edison in the last episode. It's been
a
great
stuff. I love when you get
so cool.
To play in history as you go, even in like little tiny ways where you see like the first automobile come through, and it's just a sort of backdrop to everything else that's going on.
Now, do you find when you're doing this kind of work and looking into this kind of stuff, have you found that you're opening yourself up to the idea more of the possibility of the paranormal, or are you becoming more of the Houdini in real life as well and just seeing this as not really possible?
The Houdini that I sort of love the most is, and I fall very much in line with him in terms of, you know, I'm skeptical, but I think what actually his, the engine behind him sort of, you know, pulling the rug out from under all of these mediums and being such a hardened skeptic was that, you know, his drive was that he actually really wanted to find a real medium. He wanted to find someone that really convinced him that it was real. He wanted to find proof of it because some part of him did believe in it all. And I guess that's where I sort of come into it. Like, because I don't have all the answers, and because there's too many things in my life that have not quite added up. The math isn't there, and leaves you with just, you know, sort of scratching your head and wondering. I guess, you know, I would love to have that moment where it's, you know, it's tangible to me, or it's, you know, the proof is on the table. And I guess there's, you know, within the skeptic there's someone who wants more answers and is sort of hopeful that there's something else, because I just I like it.
Are you have you ever had what you might consider to be a paranormal experience?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've since doing this series, I've sort of excavated an old memory that I haven't, you know, it's there, and I didn't really talk about it or think about it much afterwards because I guess I didn't want to, but. It's funny. I was shooting a movie in Prague for a long time, which is its own sort of wonderful, dark, rich city. And at the very end of months there, I went to my grandmother, grandfather used to live in this old house in Paris. And I went there. My grandmother had just passed away. And I went to this old house to sort of say goodbye to it. And it was this great old house that had been there for ages. And in the 16th Ronde Simone, you know, I went there with my buddy from New York, this giant dude that I played basketball with and is my best friend. And you can't really convince him of anything. He is the ultimate skeptic as far as I'm concerned. And so we get into this house, we drive there, and we're standing in this really old hallway, and we're looking at these pictures of, there were just sort of weird paintings of like old times in my family and stuff. And I'm standing there with Jess, my buddy, and suddenly he freaks out and he swipes the back of his head. And I mean, he's 6'4". He doesn't shake easily. And I'd never seen him do anything like this. So he's like, what was that? Someone just brushed my head. And we sort of laughed it off, but he was totally spooked, and that was the sort of first episode of that. And then about a month and a half later, I went back with a girlfriend, and we were sleeping in the same hallway, in a bedroom just off of that hallway, and I went to the bathroom and come back, and I see this weird sort of amorphous shape at the end of the hallway, and I'm half asleep, and, you know, I don't really think anything, but because of that thing with Jess, I just stopped and I watch it, and I'm trying to, you know, focus and see if it's really there, and it sort of glides away, and the hallway is now empty, and I go, oh, I'm obviously asleep, and I walk into the next room, and there is my girlfriend sitting straight up, like petrified, pale, and sort of in the same state that Jess was. And this house had been occupied by the Gestapo. It had sort of, you know, it's a beautiful old house, but it had this sort of sinister, you know, history to it. And my grandfather had passed away there, and, you know, there wasn't anything really, you know, you didn't just feel like there was anything bad about it or evil or scary, but there was definitely a presence, and she was convinced she saw a ghost, and then we just sort of lay there and stared at the ceiling for about 4 hours and pretended we were going to sleep. But it was one of those things that you can't really put your finger on, but there's too many things that don't really add up, and I felt it too, and I was totally, you know, my hair was standing on end, And yet, you know, then you go on with your life and it sort of fades into the you know, the distance, and it becomes a little hazier, and you go, I don't know, what the heck was it? So that's my memory of that moment, and it's enough for me to say, I don't know, you know, I have no idea, and why not? There's something there. And I'd say, you know, just not to have a run-on sentence here, but I did a movie once where I had to go to a morgue, and I think the thing more than anything, where you watch these guys and they're in, you know, like, you know, the LA County morgue, and you see so many dead bodies, like real dead humans, and then driving out of that after, you know, a few hours there, were, you know, on my way home, and you see people that are walking around, and they're so filled with their own energy of whatever that is that makes them alive. And when you see a dead body in life, it has none of that. It's like a piece of plastic. It just is lifeless. And I think that also was something that, you know, you try and wonder, you know, put your finger on exactly what it is that makes life, that makes a spirit, that makes, what is that energy? And it's, and it's impossible to really put your finger on, because there's something else there besides just, you know, chemistry working and, you know, someone walking around.
Right. There's something miraculous about what we are and how we work.
And even in the mundane driving home, you see it in people's eyes. There's something there that makes them them. And that moment after that was moving to me, and made me also sort of just step back and be like, what are we? I have no idea.
Well, Michael, you've got the season finale this Friday, or this Monday, July 4th, on Fox. And people can check out the Fox On Demand and catch all of the episodes. This is a good weekend to do it if you've got downtime.
Hey, if you have some time to kill, do it. I feel like it's a really fun series. It's full of adventure and good back and forth. Wonderful actor, Stephen Mangum, you might know from Episodes. And an up-and-coming, lovely talent in the first female constable in Adelaide Stratton, played by Rebecca Lydiard. And I think the three of us, especially as the series goes on, we really, our chemistry is fun and grows, and great writing by David Shore and Hovelton and David Titcher, three really wonderful writers. David Shore, of course, created House. So a really wonderful creative bunch, and just a joy to do.
Very cool. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us tonight and kicking off our Houdini and Doyle evening, and much continued success. I hope that we'll see a season 2, 3, and 4 of Houdini and Doyle at least. And hopefully you'll visit us again when you get there.
I would love to, Dave. Thanks so much for all your support. It's been really fun.
Always, Michael. Thank you very much. Houdini and Doyle, Monday nights on Fox. You can check your local listings for times and channels in your area. And remember to check it out on demand on Fox. Or if you have Hulu, you can find the episodes there. And I highly suggest, as a Houdini and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle fan, it is a fun fest. It is a great kind of homage to the X-Files and our history. So go check it out and have a good time with us in Houdini and Doyle season finale this Monday. When we come back, David Jayer will join me, the Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. Coast to Coast AM is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tonight and evening with Houdini and Doyle. Joining me now to talk about his book, The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World, David Jayer. And David received a BA from Brandeis University and an MFA in film production from New York University. At NYU, he was recipient of the WTC Johnson Fellowship for Directing, and he's been a screenwriter and professional astrologer, a New York native and resident. This is his first book. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us this evening, David.
Hi, Dave. Great to be here. Thank you.
What drew your attention to this specific part of Houdini's life that you wanted to cover in this book?
Well, I guess I've always been interested as to whether or not you can scientifically validate supernatural phenomena. And, you know, Houdini was at the center of this, you know, the psychical research movement, which, you know, was this venture after World War I that was primarily interested in exactly that, in trying to establish scientific proof of supernatural phenomena. But, you know, there was a lot at stake. This was right after World War One, and you had millions and millions of people who died during the war. And then during the subsequent influenza epidemic, which also took a disproportionate amount of young people. So, you know, the burning question during that time was, what is the outcome of death? And, you know, it was a situation where you had, you know, not only Houdini, who was center stage so far as this pursuit, but some of the great scientists in the world. And I just thought, it was an incredible situation to have, you know, Nobel Prize winning scientists linking hands in the seance room with magicians and spirit mediums trying to establish proof of psychic phenomena and proof of survival after the grave.
This story in particular, I mean, this was an interesting aspect of Houdini's life. Here was a guy who was kind of the Madonna of his time, right? I mean, he was constantly reinventing himself. And as he started off doing some magic tricks when everybody could do the magic, he moved more into the bigger illusions. And as everybody started to try to master and copycat his illusions, he became the great escape artist. And then in his later years, suddenly he turned into this debunker of the spiritual realm, where he really kind of took it upon himself to kind of face off against the world's most famous mediums and psychics and show people how they were done. As a matter of fact, he did a lot of those stage shows, right, where he would reenact a full seance and show exactly what was going on.
Oh, absolutely. You know, even before Houdini found success as a magician, he gave a state spirit medium act. This was during the Gilded Age in the late 1890s, around the turn of the century. He, at first he really wasn't able to find any success as a magician. He wasn't able to earn a living. So he did find some success as a false medium, and he would give what was called spook shows in those days, where he would be tied up, instruments would be placed out of his reach, and he would perform what was called the Davenport Act, where these instruments would start to play, and he would also conduct seances where he would supposedly bring messages from the dead. But, you know, Houdini was not genuine, psychic phenomena, but Houdini became spooked himself because the audiences perceived it that way. So he stopped doing it for a long, long time. But you're right, he was constantly reinventing himself. And, you know, he's an incredible cultural phenomenon. You know, between the time Teddy Roosevelt died in 1919 and Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic in 1927, Houdini was arguably the most famous American in the world, certainly the most recognizable American in the world. And, you know, you're right, he was obviously a great magician, a famous escape artist, but he always said that he wanted to do more for the world than entertain it. And that was always the driving kind of motivation in his later years. He really wanted to do something socially meaningful. And, you know, he felt that after World War One, there was this wave of interest in spiritualism and seances and spirit mediumship, and Houdini thought it was this huge post-war racket, and these false spirit mediums were exploiting the post-war bereaved. His mother had died in 1913, just before World War One broke out, and he never really recovered from that death. So he really identified with those who had lost loved ones during World War One. And, he thought that that they were being exploited by false psychics in the same way he was, because he was also a genuine medium who could, contact the spirit of his mother.
And his fascination really did kind of explode when his mom, who Houdini was very, very close to, passed away, because he wanted to see if anybody could legitimately make those connections for him, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Houdini had this incredibly passionate relationship with his mother. This was right before Freud was becoming very popular, and you could have that kind of relationship with your mother, and nobody thought anything of it. But she was the love of his life. His relationship with his wife really was second fiddle to the love he felt for his mother. And he was devastated when she died, and he never got over it.
And just for clarification for the listeners, when you say that there was this passionate love, it was nothing of the sexual nature. It was just meant in the rarest form, that it was just this all-encompassing love that he had for his mother at that time.
Exactly. And you right. could, you know, you could write your mother these kind of flowery letters, and, you know, nobody thought anything of it in those days. And, you know, it was, yeah, of course. But she did.
Well, we need to take a break real quickly, David. When we come back, let's talk about this this obsession of Houdini's to try to understand the spiritual realm and what set him off debunking. We'll do that when we return to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'll be here with you throughout the entire evening. Later on, Matt Wingert joins us to discuss his book, Conan Doyle and the Mysterious World of Light, Conan Doyle and the Occult, the author of Sherlock Holmes and his fascination with the strange and supernatural. That's what we'll wrap up this evening with. Tonight, we're talking with David Jayer, and he is the author of The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. You can find more information about our guests and about all the fantastic guests you hear by visiting coasttocoastam.com. While you're there, use keyword insider and become a member of the Coast to Coast Gallery. Very simple to do, and for a one-year subscription, breaks down to only 15 cents a day. Just 15 cents a day gives you access to over 5 years of past archived shows. That means you can hear all the shows I've hosted over the last 3.5 years, and you'll hear all the fascinating topics, guests, and more. There's live chats with George Norrie and many of the guests you hear. There's other information there as well. And if you love what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, you're going to love what you see when you join George Norrie on his TV show, Beyond Belief. Go check all that information out on the website. It's there and available for you. And while you're there, you might as well check out ParanormalDate.com. Now, close to 48,000 members. Paranormal Date, where you can meet people just like you with a fascination in the strange and supernatural world around us. You no longer have to feel alone. Meet your new best friend or the love of your life. You can be part of that 48,000 members. Go join for free. And if you decide to stay on, use keyword summer for deep discounts as a member. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. David Jayer continues as we look at the war between Harry Houdini and Psychic Marjorie, next on Coast to Coast AM. David Jayer, my guest this evening, talk to us a little bit about the Witch of Lime Street. Who was the witch, and how did she get this nickname?
Well, the Witch of Lime Street was Mina Crandon. This was during the early 1920s, and a Scientific American...
David, if I could get you to speak up just a little bit, where you're fading on us, you're a little quiet, it's hard to hear.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Dave. This was during the 1920s, early 1920s, and the Scientific American had sponsored a contest called the Psychic Contest. They were trying to find that one psychic whose phenomena could stand up to scientific scrutiny, and they'd invited some of the great scientists in America to judge this contest, along with the magician Houdini. And, you know, they investigated a number of psychics, and they determined that they were all charlatans. All these contestants were disqualified one after another. And then Mina Crandon came along, and, one difference between her and other psychics who were competing for this prize was that she was married to an aristocratic Boston doctor. She lived in Beacon Hill. She never took money for her seances. If she won the contest, she pledged to donate the money to psychic research, the prize money. So her reputation just seemed beyond dispute, and her phenomena was just incredible. I mean, she would hold these seances, and, they say that anything that wasn't tied down was liable to take flight in the seance room. You know, tables would rise, objects would fly around the room. She would be put in a spirit cabinet, and it would spontaneously just explode. She convinced a number of these scientists that she was a genuine psychic, that she had genuine mediumistic powers. And, of course, the last scrutiny she had to pass was the magician Houdini. They had a fierce rivalry in 1924. And, one of the reasons she did become so famous was because of that rivalry with Houdini. And, the summer of 1924, she's on the front page of major newspapers like the New York Times and the Boston Herald and the Boston Globe practically as often as the President of the United States. And it just shows, how this competition between she and Houdini had just captured the public imagination.
This ability, and You said that when the Scientific American, they were doing this, they had a special panel of skeptics and critical thinkers that were looking at these different claims by psychics and mediums. What about Mina? What about her and her abilities was able to hoodwink all of these people besides Houdini, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that the judges on this panel were all skeptics. It was a very interesting selection of judges. You know, certainly Houdini was a skeptic, but you know, there was in those days there was this merging of science and psychic research. So, for instance, one of the judges was William McDougall, who was the head of Harvard Psychology, but McDougall was also the president of the American Society of Psychical Research. You know, so it just shows how this interest in the supernatural and you know, was merging with hard science. You also had Daniel Comstock, who was one of the top physicists at MIT. And then, you know, you also had what would be considered today ghost hunters, people like Eric Carrington and Walter Prince. And, you know, one of the things that really stood out about Mina Crandon, who she later took on the stage name Marjorie, was that her, you know, she was a physical medium, which was really what they were looking for. So, you know, she wasn't that kind of psychic who would channel information from your dead aunt. You know, she, you know, her specialty was physical phenomena, and they, you know, that was what they were looking for, because, you know, they thought that was something that was scientifically verifiable. And, you know,
well, and can you explain for our listeners who may not be familiar, what's the difference between a medium and psychic and a physical medium?
Well, the psychic who channels information from the dead, you know, most of the psychics that you hear about today, they're not doing the kinds of things that Mina Crandon did, that Marjorie did. Marjorie would use her psychic force to make things happen around her, you know, things that were physically apparent. So, you know, a lampshade might fly across the room. You might feel this cold breeze from nowhere. You would see these spirit lights and apparitions that would manifest in the seance room. And there are, you know, these kind of violent poltergeist effects. You know, as I mentioned before, she would be placed in a spirit cabinet, and the cabinet would spontaneously just break apart. There was one seance, and, you know, I'm not saying this happened, but it was testified by some of the top physicians in Boston who happened to be there at the time, that the seance table actually rose and chased one of the sitters out of the seance room and down the hallway. So, you know, nobody had ever, in America, you know, these scientists had never come across a medium with that kind of power and that kind of force. And, you know, one of the questions you asked me before was how she got her nickname. Well, you know, in ancient times, when a psychic would channel information from the spirits, they were usually sort of, you know, a passive vessel. I mean, they were just basically a conduit, and they were channeling this information to people. But when somebody actually uses their psychic force to make things happen, you know, to cause objects to move and to use their force in more violent ways and more overt ways, well, then, you know, they're no longer considered a psychic. They're considered a witch. And Houdini did not give Marjorie her nickname. He was not the one who called her the Witch of Lime Street. But, you know, the things that she was doing were, you know, could be considered witchcraft in a way. And, you know, Houdini, when he had his rivalry with her, he was consciously trying to witchify her to the American public. You know, he wanted to associate her with witchcraft and with black magic. You know, when a witch trial takes place, one of the things you traditionally accuse a witch of is voodoo, and Houdini claimed that she had made this Houdini effigy, and she was sticking pins in it, and she put a curse on his head. You know, another thing that traditionally you accuse a witch of is some sort of deviant sexuality, and Houdini thought Marjorie was this almost mythic seductress who could seduce any man and get them to do her bidding, and he thought she'd actually seduced a number of these scientists who had declared her genuine during the Scientific American contest. The third thing you often accuse a witch of during a witch trial is some sort of mischief with children. And Houdini and one of the Boston Herald reporters were investigating these rumors that Marjorie and her husband, this aristocratic Boston doctor, were bringing these children over from England to see if they were suitable for adoption. And Houdini did not think that some of these kids were making it back to England when they were found not suitable for adoption. So Houdini, you know, he was consciously trying to witchify Marjorie. You know, America, a predominantly Christian country, you know, witchcraft is anathema in the Bible, as is spirit mediumship. So Houdini was trying to basically conduct a modern-day witch trial. And
So let me get this straight. Houdini, who was a skeptic, Houdini, who was out there trying to prove, and many people thought he actually possessed real magical ability, not just illusion magic and sleight of hand, but there were many people, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who believed he had some kind of supernatural abilities himself. Here he is, and he's trying to approach us as though she's bewitching and she has some kind of powers and ability to sway people.
Yeah, but he never, you know, that you hit on one of the great paradoxes of what Houdini was doing, because on the one hand, he's saying that, you know, she has these powers that are traditionally ascribed to witches. On the other hand, he's saying she's a fraud, that she doesn't have genuine supernatural gifts. So, you know, basically what he said is, you know, she's practicing these satanic rituals, but he doesn't actually have those powers. And, you know, certainly there are people who thought Houdini was, you know, that every time he gave, you know, one of his, you know, incredible escapes, that he was basically the personification of what he was seeking. You know, a genuine psychic. Conan Doyle thought he had genuine supernatural powers, but Houdini never claimed to have those powers. And in fact, you know, it was against the mandate of the Society of American Magicians for any magician to claim that they had genuine supernatural powers. And so, you know, Houdini came up against this woman who, you know, basically he thought she was a magician in disguise, and she was claiming, you know, that she had these supernatural gifts. So in his mind, she is a rival magician claiming to have powers that she doesn't have. So, you know, Houdini went after her, and he tried to basically humiliate her before the public by, you know, performing what his rendition of what she did, but doing it through trickery and showing the public how he could replicate her phenomena through trickery. But, you know, in some ways, if you believe that she was a fraud, then the story becomes even more mysterious because, you know, Houdini, of course, this great escape artist, this incredible athlete, you know, he's able to show how he can reproduce her phenomena by trickery. But how is the society wife from Boston able to pull off this elaborate magic act that, you know, only a handful of great magicians should have been able to pull off at that period? So, you know, it's a really interesting mystery because, you know, either way, it's very hard to you know, get at the bottom of how Marjorie was able to manifest this phenomenon.
Now, was Marjorie the one that they created the spirit cabinet for as part of his testing?
Oh, well, spirit cabinets have been around for many years. You know, a spirit cabinet is basically this wood frame cabinet, usually with a curtain in front, because it was believed that when a psychic manifests ectoplasm, it needs to be done in privacy because the medium produces it and secretes it from the orifices in her body. So she needs privacy in order to produce that ectoplasm. So a spirit cabinet was a way in which a medium could have that privacy, but yet there were enclosures in the cabinet for her to stick out her arms and legs so that those arms and legs could be controlled by the sitters in the seance circle to make sure she wasn't using her limbs to, you know, do anything to cause any kind of phenomena that the spirits could have been responsible for. And what Houdini did during these seances and during the psychic contest, he basically built his own version of the spirit cabinet for Marjorie that he claimed was fraudproof, and he put her in that cabinet during his test.
All right, she would be in the. Why do you think she would agree to do these tests if she was if she truly was a fake and fraud? You would think she would have avoided being put to the test by Houdini, because, you know, obviously she's up against a great mind who knows the ins and outs of this. So that makes kind of a fascinating dichotomy in this whole story as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's a question that a lot of the psychic researchers of the time were asking. You know, Walter Prince, who was the research officer of the American Society for Psychical Research, you know, he said about Marjorie, he said, you know, that there are some people who are geniuses in this world, and she just may be one of them. And, you know, if you consider her a fraud, if you consider what she was doing in Magic Act, you know, then obviously it was an incredible challenge for her to you know, as you said, basically subject herself to all this kind of draconian restraint that Houdini would impose on her. You know, but by that time, you know, she was in a situation where she was about to be awarded the prize, and Houdini was the last judge whose scrutiny she had to pass. And, again, you know, whether or not you believe Marjorie was a fraud or the reader believes Marjorie is a fraud, I think she believed she was genuine. And, you know, it was very interesting what was going on psychologically. But, you know, at that point, you know, she had so much success and she'd already subjected her to, you know, all this, you know, this strict regimen of tests and control that the scientists had imposed, and she'd always won. You know, she'd always been able to come out on top in the end, and I guess she figured that would happen with Houdini as well. You know, there's no question that part of her strategy, you know, had to do with her charisma and had to do with, you know, forming a close bond with the scientists who had tested her. And, you know, so what was going on with Houdini and Marjorie was also fascinating, because Houdini wasn't a scientist. And, you know, Houdini was one of the great sort of personifications of male virility at that time. And, you know, if you go back to mythology, you know, there are always these sort of rites of passage where you have this virile hero who has to encounter the sorceress. And it's like, you know, this contest between his physical power, or his power and physical force and his rectitude, when he comes up when he comes against a seductress who, you know, uses her sorcery to ensnare and enslave men. You know, you have Odysseus you have Circe who basically enslaves all of Odysseus's men and seduces them. And, you know, she tries to seduce Odysseus, and that's a great challenge. You have to stand up to her. You know, the same thing happens with King Arthur and Morgan Le Fay. You know, she tries to seduce him and steal Excalibur and emasculate him by stealing his sword. So, you know, what you have with Houdini, you know, is a great heroic figure of that time coming up against the sorceress. Is sort of this ancient kind of competition on a modern stage. And so Houdini has to prove that he is the one person, and, you know, he says this again and again, that he believes he has seduced all these other judges, and he is going to be the one judge who can stand up to her charm and stand up to her seductive gift.
Fascinating stuff. When we come back, let's explore more of this battle. And I'm left wondering, because he was such a marketing genius, because he was always in the forefront of keeping himself in the public eye, and these two both benefited so greatly, I wonder if there was ever any discussion that perhaps they were working together in conjunction to create this almost Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier kind of sense, where they were transcending what they were doing and bringing it to a different level. We'll talk more with our guest David Jayer about The Witch of Lime Street, Seance, Seduction, and Houdini in the Spirit World. And remember, set your DVRs for Houdini and Doyle season finale this Monday on Fox. We'll be back with more of the best in overnight talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.